Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to have today the two authors of the just published book out from MIT Press titled Playing Oppression, The Legacy of Conquest and Empire in Colonialist Board Games. This is a really interesting book that analyzes board games, something that I think could have more attention put on it generally, and looks particularly at the board game's roots in imperialism, in colonialism, and traces that all the way up to the present to examine something that maybe a lot of us take for granted and don't think about through this lens. The book does a very good job of persuading us that we should. And so I'm pleased to have with us the two authors of the book, Dr. Mary Flanagan and Dr. Michael Jacobson, to tell us about their wonderful book.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the invite.
I'm glad
that
you both said
yes. Thank you for having us.
Before we get into the book, I was wondering if you could maybe each introduce yourselves and explain sort of how you came to write this book and how you came to write it together. So Mary, if I can go to you first.
Right. So I'm a game designer and someone who's written other books about games and play, often from historical or large-scale perspectives. My book, Critical Play, is kind of traces an art history of games. And so I've been engaged with all kinds of play and game studies for quite a long period of time. And Mikhail and I know each other since, did we figure out it was 2003 or something like this?
I think it's 2000, yeah, but somewhere around like there.
Yeah, so we've known each other for a long period of time in the same kind of game studies circles. And we happened to be at a board game studies conference in Europe. And, you know, I was just at Essen and we were talking about, which is a board game kind of convention in Germany, one of the largest board game events in the world. And it's the prevalence of colonialist imagery, of colonial fantasies, of this Raiders of the Lost Ark or exoticism or whatever this, you know, these kind of tropes were continuing to be published. We just started talking about this and just with disgust and saying, how is this possible in this day and age? So that was about, what, 2017? Was that? Yeah. And so we both shared similar viewpoints. And interestingly, we're both born in the same year, but in very different parts of the world. But it all kind of ended up gelling that we wanted to work on a book that really unpacked this stuff from a really deep level.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And when we started talking about things, I think you were the one who said that, we are really interested in the same thing, but from two different perspectives. You came at it more from a historical perspective of tracing the roots and looking at how we've gotten to where we are today. And I had really just sort of started seeing these themes repeating over and over again in board games that I was looking at for other reasons. So I was really focused on the sort of here and now contemporary board games. So I think that's where the idea of if we join forces, we sort of got it all covered.
That makes rather a lot of sense, and definitely explains kind of the breadth that the book is able to cover. And to speak to that, I want to ask, how does one research a book about board games? How did you kind of put all this together? What were your methods like? How many board games did you end up having to play?
Oh boy. Maybe Mikit will go into like this idea of the spreadsheet.
Yeah, so for me, it was about not just looking at games and reading the rules and looking at the pieces, but also getting these games played so we can see what arguments they make in action, if you will, because that's, after all, an important aspect of games as a medium compared to other popular culture formats. So I'm still counting, because even though the book is out, there's still things that needs to be delved into further. So right now in the game lab at MIT, we have over 1,000 games that we've collected for this study, and we've played recently, we hit 350. So that's just on my site. So of course, Mary has also played a lot of them, but she also did a lot of traveling for this project.
Yes, I went to a lot of small archives, small game museums. I actually took about a month and a half taking a train around Germany, looking at small places. I went to different state museums and met with archivists who didn't have some of their games out, but they had them in stock in the archives. I also, some of this core research I was pursuing kind of by surprise when I was a museum scholar at the Getty Museum in the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles. So it's been years of archival work for me. A lot of really rich stuff at the Bodleian and at Oxford and many really interesting archives around the world. But also, it's important to note that there is no one master record of board games around the world. There's no encyclopedic location to find them. There's no collection that has some kind of authority about this stuff. There really is no core place to go for board games. Some museums have there's a Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, but it doesn't necessarily have the historical material. So it's really interesting to research this part of ephemeral pop culture that has been overlooked and is actually a site for a lot of human interaction over the last several hundred years that has not really been critically unpacked. So for us, we're using a lot of different kinds of methods, mixed methods, to tackle this, from experiential play to archival research and everything in between, and of course post-colonial theory as a lens to look at this stuff.
thank you for both explaining kind of the many different pieces and hours and months that went into this. I think it really comes through in the book. And I think, Mary, that's also a wonderful call for anyone listening to this who might be in search of a research project. It sounds like there's a lot to kind of get into in this area. But in order to do that, in order to go into the arguments that you were able to put together with all of these methods, there's one, I think, key definition we might need to discuss first, which is the category of games that the book focuses on, Euro games. What exactly are those?
To begin with, the term sort of started out being different things like German games or designer games, and then it sort of coalesced into the term Euro games. And basically what we mean when we talk about Euro games is modern board games. Roughly, if we wanted to give it a date of origin, I would say 1995, when Settlers of Catan came out in Germany. But already before that, there had been this movement in Germany to create board games that weren't just for kids, but were for sort of interest to the whole family. And that actually, in many ways, started in the US decades earlier, but it didn't really take off in the US. We had a period where there were things like the bookshelf series of board games that were sold more in men's clothing stores or barber shops and places like that. But financially, it didn't take off here, but it did in Germany. And we hypothesized that maybe it has something to do with the very terminology we use when we talk about games. So I'm from Sweden, so a Germanic language. So we have a term for these games that doesn't really exist in English. We suffered a bit in trying to translate it, but landed on companionship games. So Gemeinschaftsspiel or Sällskapsspel in Swedish. And it's sort of an age-neutral term. It doesn't say this is a children's game or this is a family game or this is a game for adults, which always was, you know, the branding issue in the US. So some of these US designers that found themselves without publishers in the US found an audience in Germany, and even some of them moved to Europe, where the audience existed, and sort of sowed a seed for this creative explosion among board game designers in Germany during the 1990s. Mary, do you want to add?
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit to that. Thanks. It was, I think you did a great job with kind of positioning Euro games. I mean, in the book, we kind of trace post-World War II games and look at the developments of those, especially in Germany, where militaristic play, Nazi stuff, you know, there were so many kind of banned ideas for playthings that actually before the rise of the Weimar Republic and all of that were kind of very commonplace. War games were very common. Kind of strategic games, you know, were published in Boy Scout equivalent magazines. There was a lot of planning and wargaming and this kind of stuff. And all of that had to go. And so this idea that Euro games are these complex, thinky games that involve a lot of, you know, multiple ages, that are nonviolent, that use a lot of different kinds of strategic decision-making, the introduction that players could have multiple kinds of actions and decide which kind of action they would like to take on a given turn, etc. These kinds of things were all tied into some of the political, social stuff after World War II also. So there's several ways that Eurogames emerged to be what are now just contemporary board games, I guess.
Thank you both for sort of piecing all of those things together and helping us understand both what it is now, but kind of the different strands that got us here, because that's really helpful in helping us understand what we currently have, right? They come from somewhere and that has an impact. And in fact, a lot of the book is tracing over time and space different colonialist, imperialist, colloquially nasty, perhaps, ways that some of these board games operate, either in their imagery, what they're actually talking about, and a whole bunch of other things. My kind of assumption coming into reading this part of the book was that there would be some amount of change over time, that there might be something, you know, pre-colonial board games. I was like, maybe that's a thing. I don't know. Peak colonial board games, post-colonial board games. Those were kind of the very rough categories in my own head. And thankfully, I'm not the expert on it. That's why we're talking to you all. So could you maybe take us through what sorts of depictions of the world, kind of conceptions of the world, how have they changed through time?
Well, I'll jump in and do some of the groundwork for some of the older stuff. Because, you know, board games, at least in their current form in the West, have emerged from, you know, the invention of the printing press. You have broadsheets. A lot of times, if you're in an archive, old board games will be included in the prints and the print division, not necessarily in, you know, another kind of division, because many of them were lithographs or other kinds of printed ephemera, right? And it's really interesting when you delve into some of these things. There were plenty of depictions of the world. For example, Le Jeu du Monde, the Game of the World, published in 1645, had this round board. It was a race board, kind of, we call it the Game of the Goose structure, but that's just because it's a historic model for gameplay, where you go around the board and you have your little spaces, you know, something very familiar to us now, even today. But these board games were also made by map makers and printers of ephemera. So you have a very distinct connection to map making and kind of seeing the world through this kind of map-based thing. So geographical pastimes were actually kind of a thing. But things changed very much in the 19th century as manufacturing techniques changed, but also as ideas changed in Europe, and the colonial structures really gave root to a kind of, in effect, kind of a marketing ploy, where the William Darton's The Noble Game of Elephant and Castle in 1822 is this visually stunning game depicting various aspects of Asia. But it's really super problematic. But it's a beautiful object. So it really does kind of capture the way that Europeans were being positioned to look at the world through various educational structures. This is also the time of the tourist gaze and, you know, lecture circuits of people talking about their world travels, and governments such as the British government trying to get colonists to move to some of these places by exoticizing them. So there are many, many layers to the depictions, but they're often, you know, stereotypical, racist, oversimplifying cultural practices. And very much, in at least the 19th and 20th, or basically, yeah, the 19th century, really, taking on this tourist gaze, to kind of know the world by, you know, traveling through it. And things change quite a bit in the 20th century, in the sense that at the turn of the 20th century, things got much more, even more racist. it got worse, which is hard to imagine. To go to, you know, and contemporary games have inherited this stuff. And our big treatise in the book is that it's not just representation. It's not just pictures that are horrible, right? It's actually what you're doing in games, how the games have developed, and even what we call game mechanics, what you're doing in games may have, we put forward, developed because of colonial themes as a key part of games and not as a kind of add-on. So even what you're doing in games have colonialist roots. And that is probably, to people who love board games, a hard thing to confront.
Yeah, I think it's often seen as like the mechanical layer of, or the things that you do in the game that makes you have the experience that you have, that somehow just is what it is. It's a given. And then we give games different themes. So I think the argument that maybe we could dress these mechanics in something else than conquest and slavery is easier to take to heart than saying that maybe the mechanics themselves also are telling a story of exploitation and resource mongering. But we do think that if the history of the world had been different, we would also have different mechanics in our board games, and we would think that those are, you know, by nature given to us, and it couldn't be any other way. So we're questioning that assumption that the mechanics are somehow neutral.
So I'm wondering if I could ask sort of for an example of that, right? Because this idea of it's not just the images you see, but what you're actually doing in the game. Obviously, the book has quite a number of examples, so the task of choosing which one to talk about is probably difficult. But could you explain what you mean and how this actually works in practice in terms of enacting these colonialist behaviors through a particular example?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll just kind of run down a list of some mechanics, and maybe we should delve into, I don't know, Puerto Rico?
Yeah, that one stood out in the book.
Yeah, it stands out. It stands out. It continues to stand out. So, for example, we look in the book at even something as simple, seemingly simple, as quiz mechanics. There are these little quizzes that came about, you know, how to be a good citizen and show that you know the British Empire and show this and this, you know, and you a well-educated person would know these trivial facts. Well, if that seems like a neutral mechanic until you look at the content being developed with these quiz games. The content with the quiz games is often just rife with imperialist, cultural superiority built in, and by answering the quiz and getting answers correct, you're actually reinforcing the mechanic of like, aha, I got it right. There is a right answer. This is the way to see the world. And so even something as simple as a quiz mechanic has a kind of reifying force when coupled with content that can be highly problematic. There's touring and traveling, seizing territory, trading mechanics are a big part of Euro games. And that's also, of course, linked to colonialist practices. Collecting all of the things, you know, whether it be resources or whatever, it's kind of endless resources that can be extracted and sent somewhere for someone's benefit. That itself, you know, local people probably wouldn't see their own resources that way. They might see them in a different way and for a sustainable community. So these mechanics, many mechanics mirror colonial mechanics of trade and expansion, but and they embody this like kind of logic of colonial practices. But But we could go into a specific detail with Puerto Rico, for example.
Yeah, so I think this is a good time for me to state that I claim no sort of ethical or moral high ground here, because I see myself in a lot of these designers and design decisions. They tend to be white European men of roughly my age that were sort of around when this sort of explosion that I mentioned earlier happened within German board game design, where they reached critical mass and started learning from each other and challenging each other to make more and more interesting board games. And I think it comes from the cultural climate we were all embedded in. It was the movies we were watching. It was the comic books we were reading. It was even the history books that we were reading in school that sort of taught us that this is just how things are. And in that regard, I think these board games are kind of often like history fan fiction. And I think Puerto Rico is a good example of that. So it makes the assumption that the land itself only really is there to be exploited and kind of serves as our playground. So what you do in the game is that you play colonial governors who build up refineries and other factories and develop the fields where you can grow crops like tobacco and cotton, etc. And then you ship the resources ideally the refined resources back to the old world, and what you get is money and fame, basically, which is tracked in terms of victory points, which is a very common way of determining who the winner is going to be in these games. So it has a model of extraction and becoming rich and famous without looking at where does this really come from and what do we leave behind. So that's a very common model for what I sometimes call machine building games. So you build up a system that gives you more and more resources until you turn it all into victory points at the end to see who the winner is.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for explaining kind of the pieces that go into that and the ways in which I think, Mary, you said the kind of the reinforcement between the images and what you're doing and these imperialist and colonial implications, worldviews, I suppose. I wanted to pick up on something, Mikhail, you just mentioned, the kind of explosion in popularity. And of course, we talked about this a little bit with the idea of what is a Euro game. Why did board games kind of become much more popular in the 20th century, or did they become loads more popular, or do we just have better documentation of it? Kind of, how do we think about the role of popularity in this?
Well, they didn't, board games as a whole didn't really become more popular, because we have the family games like Monopoly and so on that still make up for the large bulk of what people are playing when they are playing board games. But what we sometimes think of as the board game hobby, with people who are really dedicated fans of playing board games and play maybe 20, 30 new games every year, that is a relatively new phenomenon. And I think of it as, so there are financial reasons, going back again to post-war Germany, publishers like Ravensburger, for instance, saw that they were selling a lot of games like Clue or Cluedo for our British audience, or Monopoly and Risk and so on, but they weren't, they didn't own the intellectual property, so they had to pay other owners to publish the game. So they started doing competitions where German designers could submit games and win an award. And then that led to those games getting a lot of press, so they would sell well, especially for the Christmas or season in Germany. So this became kind of an engine within board game development in Germany, where more and more people got interested in making games because they saw people actually making money from this, which was a new concept. And they learned from each other, because they knew that the juries of these prizes, they were looking for the next cool thing. So you couldn't just repeat like a Monopoly formula or something like that. You had to invent something new in order to win these awards. And then they learned a lot from each other. And this, I think, went on for like the 80s and 90s, before the bubble kind of burst and this new type of games sort of reached outside of the German borders, and especially in the US, Settlers of Catan had an important role there in sort of breaking the floodgates, and then we started seeing US publishers and board game retailers importing German games and asking for English translations of German games. And we started seeing board game clubs and so on evolving here. So that was how it became the hobby it is today.
Thank you. Mary, is there anything you want to add about that?
I mean, that was pretty good.
It was pretty good. All right. Well, I'm happy to move on to the next question, which goes back to that kind of false idea that I had in my head coming into this book of the pre-colonial, the peak colonial, and the post-colonial board game. Because I admit, I definitely had a vague idea in my head that board games are still quite popular, and therefore they now, new board games, the ones that are coming out now, they're not colonial, surely. They don't have any of this sort of imagery or problematic aspects. And of course, your answer already about game mechanics helps kind of start to clear away the assumptions I made that were not actually accurate, that a lot of those mechanics are still there. And a lot of times they are still in these new games. But I was really quite struck that even just beyond the kind of, well, we still have quizzes, well, we still have this, there were a lot of new games, recent games that still seem to be pretty colonial. Why?
Yes. It's amazing. It's an amazing horror. I don't understand how it's the last bastion of being culturally sensitive or something. There has been, you know, and this is actually true a little bit in the history of video games as well. This idea that, it's just a plaything. It's just a game. Therefore, it's not important. It doesn't have to represent difficult things in culture. In fact, it can just mess with culture and make whoever our target audience is happy and content with their empowerment in the world. Because as a game player, you want to give your player, as a game designer, you want to give your player some kind of agency. Well, you have a lot of agency as a colonial empire, it turns out. And you don't have a lot of agency if you are a colonized people. So this kind of quest, you know, it's like this adventure swashbuckling thing. You know, you see it in films, but it's definitely getting a serious look in cinema, but it's still lingering on. Now, there have been some recent improvements. The creators of Puerto Rico have recently reskinned their game to set it in a time when Puerto Rico had more agency. And because in the game there's, and we could talk about this at length, about there are these characters who are called colonists, but are they really colonists or are they slaves? And there are new games coming out. In the last chapter of our book, we do point to hopeful places, right? There is hope and there is a lot of innovation in trying to really dig up some of these tropes, right? And really redo them. But we just wanted to first off just start by identifying them and by, you know, bringing this stuff to light, because really there has been no academic book that's done this. There have been some really great bloggers and some, you know, game critics who've brought up pieces of this stuff, but we really wanted to kind of start off with a systematic way that we could begin to improve. And so I think, and hopefully our book goes to that, you know, optimistic direction, but yes, it's kind of amazing. I was just at the Cannes Game Festival in France, I guess it was last weekend or the weekend, but it was recently. And, you know, you get on a ship and you're doing something in Jamaica and you're not Jamaican. You know, the characters are not Jamaican doing their own thing. It's all these, colonized situations and yeah, it just keeps happening.
Why do you think it's persisted?
Yeah.
Sorry, Michael. So you might jump in.
Yeah, sorry. Can you give me the question again?
Yeah, I mean, to both of you, really. Why has this strong colonial imprint and worldview in games persisted so much, even till now?
So I think Mary kind of touched on it, but I think it's because board games in general are still made and published by the privileged for the privileged. Without thinking about it, that is how the system works. So it takes a long time to exact change on systems like this. So while our overall sense is still that, why is this still like this in 2023, we do see kind of glimmers of hope, but we do see a bit of a sort of early signs of a changing of the guard, even, you know, like at higher up positions in the big publishing companies. But it is like this big oil tanker that just goes extremely slowly when it comes to changing course and changing sort of ideas and mindsets.
Well, it would only be fair to ask both of you to tell us about those glimmers of hope and those changes that are beginning to happen. What are some of the reasons to be optimistic about the future of board games?
Well, I would say, first of all of the younger designers entering the field. You know, for a long time, before we had crowdfunding, we had the publishing houses were quite in control of messages, right? So it was a very centralized model where you had to get a publisher to be able to afford to publish a board game. The crowdfunding, it's a mixed bag. It does allow new voices to emerge. It also, you know, allows problematic games to come out as well at the same time. So it's a transition period, I think. There are plenty of really positive examples. Like, I'm thinking of Coyote and Crow, which is a role-playing game that was kickstarted in 2021. And it's a speculative, we don't really talk about too much about role-playing games, but this one is particularly noteworthy because it's a speculative role-playing game in which Europeans never colonized the Americas. And it's created by a team of Native Americans representing more than a dozen tribes. So it's trying to like propose the world that could be. Then there's a game, Nunami, which is a game by a Native Canadian in Quebec, who's really looking at kind of cultural mythos as well as creating a puzzle game. So they're really interesting nuggets. And in a few weeks, I'll be doing a discussion with Shelf Stories and the game Spirit Island, which is set an interesting bar for a lot of new games. It's a game where there are these very skinny white pieces that are kind of scary conquistadors looking, who come to this, who are trying to settle this island, and players are playing in the part of deities who fight on behalf of the indigenous population, the Dahan, to protect their lands. So we're seeing these really interesting new discoveries and new designers coming out. And I think when we see proof of concept and that innovation can still happen without these terrible, stories of white supremacy, basically, we will see big game companies also coming along with that as well, because it is about innovation and it is about telling stories in a new way. But there are some growing pains that both the tabletop industry and designers really have to reckon with these notions that some of the things that have been being made are not only just questionable, they're really problematic and have to be rethought in a fundamental way.
Yeah, I also think in terms of mechanics, what I've been seeing recently is a lot of games that use resistance as a model rather than control and exploitation. So I find that interesting. And sometimes it's still on the sort of seeing like a state level of things, but it can also be expressed in more sort of individual, more documentary manners. Two examples that I would want to mention is one recent game called Stonewall Uprising, about the fight for gay civil rights, and another game called Arranged, which is about the custom of arranged marriages in Pakistan and India. And really what they both do is they don't put you in the role as the powerful controller of a system, but rather someone resisting a system and still creates a play experience that doesn't just feel like a sort of an educational thing that, well, that was, I guess, good to learn about, but did we have fun? No, these games are really exciting to play. And that, I think, is very promising.
Those are lots of reasons to hope. Thank you very much for giving us those examples. I'm sure lots of people will be looking up those games as we speak. But before I let you both go, Mary, you mentioned briefly a little bit of what you are looking to do next. So I was wondering, for both of you, the book is now out. Are there any things about your current projects or your next projects or anything else you might be doing that you'd like our listeners to be aware of?
Well, I suppose I should mention, because in academia, you know, we wear many different hats, right? And as I may be writing these academic books, but I also run a game company. And so I'm actively trying to reinvent solutions to these problems in real products, which is interesting. So that's an ongoing affair at resonym.com, R-E-S-O-N-Y-M. And so, I publish 1 to 2 games a year through that arm. And we're really trying to reinvent some of these assumptions and tropes, and make it work and do proof of concept. So that's one thing I'm kind of working on in an ongoing way. And I'm starting a new book on speculative game design, because that's also related to the last chapter of the book, and it's related to my practice. And that is using games as ways that we can imagine futures, right? Like games are very special because they build, you create a game and it builds a world, and the world has rules. And within those rules, you can do some really interesting stuff. So I keep trying to do a lot of social activist games, and I've had a long track record of my research lab Tilt Factor doing these kinds of things. And so I'm trying to encapsulate some ways in which speculative game design works as a practice for imagining the future in positive ways.
And I, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not quite done with sort of the critiquing of games that have a colonialist themes. Right now, I'm working with my colleague Rick Eberhardt on a paper about how we enact and set maps in motion in settler colonialist games in Anglo-America. So think like Lewis and Clark games, Oregon Trail games, Mormons, train games, Gold Rush, all of that stuff. But I'm also dipping my toes into game design. So I have a high-level prototype of a game called Promesa, which is about the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. And I made it together with the design and artist collective Popsicleta. And we did it in Puerto Rico and at MIT. And that model of cultural engagement is something that I'm very interested in exploring further in future games as well.
Well, very cool projects from both of you. Thank you so much for telling us about them. And while you are off pursuing these many different ways of critiquing what has happened, trying to fix it for the future, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, which again is titled Playing Oppression, The Legacy of Conquest and Empire in Colonialist Board Games. Mary and Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks, Miranda.
Thank you.